I'd like to call the Oil and Gas Committee meeting to order. Today we're going to get an overview from Commissioner Condon and then Commissioner Shively.
In reverse order, is that?
Commissioner Condon goes first?
No, I would go first.
Okay. That would be fine. Basically, what we're doing is gathering information on specific projects we have coming up and past excursions to generate business for Alaska. And I'd ask the commissioners to come forward at this time and give us an overview. Commissioner Shively, there's a couple of areas that I would be concerned of if you might touch on these during your report, and that would be the report of the success of your overseas trips, the administration's trips through the Orient for the purpose of gas or oil sales over there, and then also if you would touch on the area of domestic independence that might have interest in oil and gas development in the state of Alaska.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Shively. I'm the Commissioner of Natural Resources. What I thought I'd do is sort of give an overview of some of what's gone on and what we think might go on. But I think a little history is probably in order here. When I became commissioner almost 2 years ago on Saturday, things in the oil and gas business in this state didn't look very good. Both major operating companies on the North Slope were about to experience major layoffs. There was not a lot of enthusiasm about new prospects. People were somewhat pinning their hopes on ANWR, but recognizing that politically that was difficult. And we showed basically a continuing decline in oil production throughout the state. In the last 2 years, that has changed dramatically. And it's changed, I think, for two primary reasons. One is a change in attitude by the government. Both the executive branch and the governor with his ready and open for business, and the legislature with their willingness to look at new ways of doing business, whether that was HB 207, the marginal oil field bill, or area-wide leasing, or the North Star Agreement. I think we have sent a message to the oil industry that we are interested in having them to continue to operate in the state and to expand their operations. The second major influencing factor on why there is so much interest today is technology. It's issues such as directional drilling, using coiled tubing for drilling, the 3D seismic, which has been a huge benefit in terms of identifying small targets and hitting those targets when you drill, and new enhanced oil recovery. All of those are adding to the ability to produce and expand our existing reserves, but also to look at new smaller fields. Critical to that, of course, to any future development is leasing. If the state, and most oil development in this state right now is on state lands, even though we're not the largest landowner. But if we don't have a leasing program that's rational and timely and consistent, the industry really can't be prepared to do new exploration. And all of you have our new 5-year oil and gas leasing program. And I think you'll see a couple things in there that are different. But one that's not. I mean, we've tried to be consistent since I've been commissioner. We've had 2 sales a year each of the years that I've been commissioner, one on the Slope and one in Cook Inlet. And we will continue that. But the major change in our new 5-year oil and gas leasing program is that we are incorporating area-wide leasing, the bill passed by the legislature last year that was introduced both by legislators and by the governor. But we're looking at our first area-wide sale in 1998 on the North Slope, and then our first Cook Inlet area-wide sale in 1999. We will go then add a Beaufort Sea area-wide sale in 1999 also. And what we're looking at in the existing oil provinces is to use area-wide leasing. And what this does, it allows us to do a best interest finding that essentially is good for 10 years, rather than having to basically start from ground zero with our best interest findings each year. And the sales will take place in a certain month every year. So industry will know that October is Beaufort Sea area month once this gets going. So, and even for the people in the communities, including some of those who are concerned about oil and gas, there will be a set schedule. They will know where we lease and when we lease. And I think that will cut down on some of the commotion of people not being aware of what is going on. I think that area-wide leasing will be supplemented by another tool passed by the legislature several years ago, which is our exploration licensing program. And that's a program where companies can go out and look in frontier areas, make a proposal to us for a development plan, and look at those areas without going through the traditional lease system. It saves us a lot of work because often when we go into frontier areas, we don't know whether people will buy the bid on the leases or not. So if you wait for an exploration license, you know the company's interested. So I think those two things will sort of drive exploration in the future. We have a lot of interest right now on the North Slope in particular, but also in Cook Inlet. I think the Sale 85A was a real success, both in terms of bringing in some new companies like Force Energy, having people like Anadarko and UTP, a couple other independents involved. And then, of course, on the North Slope, Northstar is proceeding with development. It looks quite possible that Badami may go. Both BP and ARCO have a number of other prospects that they're looking at. And, of course, ARCO, Anadarko, and UTP are proceeding with the development of Alpine, which is right on the Colville River. That development, the Alpine development, of course, has led to renewed interest in NPRA. And that's a place, although it's federally owned, the state receives 50% of the revenues from any development. So, we're sort of pushing in both directions. We're pushing to the east with fields like Badami, and to the west with fields like Alpine. And I think there's just sort of an expansion going on up there that will have the ability to probably maybe not only meet ARCO's no decline after 99, but could actually turn the curve around some and start building production from the North Slope that's above whatever the low point becomes. Cook Inlet, of course, doesn't produce as much. However, the gas is essential to driving or fueling a South Central Anchorage economy. With people like Anadarko and Force Energy, UTP coming in down there, bringing new ideas and new enthusiasm. The smaller companies like that have a sort of different philosophy. The larger companies often have a number of reserves worldwide. They sometimes take their time looking at some of these things. But the smaller companies are really driven by, once they find a prospect, they want to look at it, they want to see if there's oil or gas there, and then they want to develop it. So it's interesting on the trips that the governor and some of us took to visit the industry leaders in Los Angeles, Houston, and London, all the companies were enthusiastic about prospects in Alaska, but each sort of had their own idea about what was going to come. I mean, they weren't all looking at the same thing. And so we've sort of gone from, what I think in the couple of years ago from people sort of say, Anwar may be the hope if we're going to have any big future production, to people having all sorts of ideas about how we're going to add to our production. We do all of this in the Department of Natural Resources with a relatively small staff. We have 53 people in the Division of Oil and Gas. Just for comparison purposes, the Minerals Management Service, who's not held an oil and gas lease sale in a number of years and has, I don't think, any producing properties in the state, has 70 people. We, of course, with our 53, not only have had two lease sales a year the last couple of years. We manage the largest oil field in North America and are dealing with the development of a variety of other fields in both Cook Inlet and on the North Slope. There are a lot of issues, and I'm not going to go into all of them in any detail, but that you should know about. The whole issue of units, how they're developed, when more oil comes on, how that fits into existing units is very technical, requires a lot of work. And as we look at things like the development of satellite fields around Prudhoe Bay, further development of Nyakuk, and new developments themselves, the discussion of units is critical and often has a major play in how much money we make off of those fields. Evaluating the resource so that we can get in our lease sales a better return. For instance, when we did our last lease sale on the North Slope, the Colville sale, we had a very aggressive royalty. The state royalty started at 16 2/3% and had a sliding scale on top of that because it was in the middle of a field where we knew some of the resource value. And so although we traditionally are at 12.5%, we have the ability when we think the resource warrants it to have higher royalties. For those of you who've been around the last couple of years and watched us on North Star and HB 207, you know that economics drives a lot of our decisions, particularly when you have to make a decision such as, is changing the North Star royalty provisions in the best interest of the state? Are royalty reductions, such as the one that UNOCAL has requested, in the best interest of the state? A lot of that is based on economic analysis. We function, for my first 2 years, with one economist, we now have three, and I think that's going to help as we look at some of these future issues. We also have an audit function, and auditing the leases is somewhat complicated. Often different leases have different terms, so it's very unlike the tax issue where the total amount of money made is really often at issue. In the royalty side of it, you have to look at the individual lease and how much oil came off of each lease, so it's a somewhat more complex situation. I will let Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Condon, talk about the trip to the Far East because he was on it and I was not. I have touched on some of the independent interest, and I'd be glad to discuss that further if you have other questions, and with that, I think I'll end my presentation.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Shively. Are there any questions of the commissioner from the members present? And I was actually remiss in not having a roll call when we first started. I wanted to get into the excitement of what was coming up, so if you'll indulge me for a second, if you would do a roll call.
Representative Bundy.
Here.
Representative Hodgins.
Here.
Representative Ogun.
I'm here.
Representative Roper, Representative Bryce, Representative Ryan.
Here.
Representative Kemplin.
Here.
Representative Logan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shively, on the 85A lease sale, I've heard some criticism that after one of the most extensive public processes in the history of the state, that there was some waffling going on at the end as far as some of the decisions that were being made, and I think people are somewhat concerned that there was a tremendous amount of time, energy, and money expended on that process, and it was thorough, and why was there people, I guess, blinking or whatever after all that long process. Do you care to comment on that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ogun, we did have a very thorough process. And over 600 people commented during that process. We had either 5 or 8 public hearings, number of public notices. But at the end, a couple of things happened that I think concerned us. It wasn't just that some people were upset, because there are people that aren't particularly supportive of oil and gas. But particularly when people around the Kenai River, some of whom the governor and I know very well, are not anti-oil development, were concerned about what we were doing and didn't seem to be informed about it. it caused us to relook at our process. And some of that was our fault. We, for instance, did not even notify our own Kenai River Management Board about the oil lease sale. And I think that it showed a couple of things. One, there was a huge lack of understanding about what's going on. We have an existing unit on the Kenai River. There are a number of existing leases in the Kenai River. We've drilled and developed in the Kenai River watershed for almost 40 years. So there are ways to protect watersheds and the Kenai River, and of course the governor and I have both made that a big priority. So we just need to do some work on that. And there were other things, like in the document, that were hard even for me to explain, such as why we had a half a mile setback on the Beluga River, which virtually no one in Alaska could find on a map, had a quarter mile setback on the Kenai River, which is probably the, you know, maybe doesn't rank with the Yukon in terms of worldwide fame, but in the state is probably our most important river in terms of usage by Alaskans. So we felt it important to go back, look at what we've done. Internally, we've made some recommendations about changes in the process to notify more people. And then we're going to have a stakeholders group to sort of go around and educate people about the 85 mitigation measures we already have, how they affect some of the concerns that people have raised, and listen to see if things like a larger setback on the Kenai River and other things make sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, I know where Beluga River is.
I just do.
Mr. Chairman. We've got a lot of Beluga River fans here. I'm just, and this is off the subject, but it's technical. Beluga River goes dry for a mile or more. Tide, Kenai does not. Is this a reason why the variety is set back, or do you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, I don't have the remotest idea.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Bundy? Thank you. Representative Kemplin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you call her and tell her no, I don't need it. No. Thank you, sir. Sorry.
Proceed.
Commissioner Shively, one of the questions or the points that has been made repeatedly by a former governor of the state is that we are an articulate spokesperson for the concept of owner state. And he has, on a regular basis, identified the need for the state to maintain the sufficient resources in terms of people to manage those assets, and that if we were a private sector corporation, we would be treating our resources and our assets, our natural assets, a little differently. You mentioned in your presentation that you have a relatively small staff. Do you feel that your department is adequately staffed to manage this owner state of ours?
Well, and that's maybe a broader question than oil and gas, but I'll confine it to oil and gas for the moment. I think we've done pretty well with our staff. We have some, particularly in oil and gas, we have some incredibly good professional people. I mean, I'm sort of surprised. Most of them come out of industry, have decided for one reason or another they prefer to work for the government. And so in some ways we make up, I think, in qualities in some ways what the industry puts out in quantity. But often the industry itself, in looking at an asset, let's say a Badami, will have more people assigned to that asset, say BP in this case, than we have in our whole department. If we were a private company managing just oil and gas for profit, we would do things a lot differently. What we are is a government managing oil and gas revenues to fund virtually everything else we do in the state. And as a result, I think we put a lot of emphasis, and appropriately as we should, on a whole variety of other things that the money goes to that a private landowner would not. And I think, you know, the long-term question for the state is how much longer we should have a situation where one industry funds virtually everything we do. And that, I think, is a challenge both for the executive branch and for the legislature.
Further questions, Representative Kinsley?
Not right now. Thank you.
Representative Ryan.
Commissioner Shively, in your various discourses with the producers on the North Slope and in some of the negotiations for their royalties and the discretion that you've been granted on, under the laws, have you or the administration ever approached a value-added manufacturer in Alaska for some of the resources that are being developed here in a raw state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, are you talking about oil and gas specifically, or? Well, we have, of course, as a state, donated some of our royalty oil to MAPCO, Petrostar, and Tesoro. And right now, as I understand it, the refining capacity in the state is in excess, and we are actually exporting some refined product. So we have done some of that, but the bulk of the resource does go outside and is refined elsewhere. And whether or not that in the future would change, I don't know. But we don't make that a requirement of our negotiations. We've sort of let the market try to drive that.
Further follow-up questions? Representative Ryan? Thank you. Any further questions? Commissioner Shively, I certainly appreciate you coming before us and giving us an overview. It'll be my intention for the Oil and Gas Committee to delve quite deeply into the resources that we have and to see how best this committee can assist you in going forward with your quest, and that would be to do the best and highest utilization of our resources. I will be asking Ken Boyd to visit us at time to time and give us technical answers to some of our questions and to keep us on tap as to what he sees we might be able to benefit your department with as far as assistance and lease sales and et cetera. I've got a couple questions here today, and if they might be better answered by Mr. Boyd, I would certainly appreciate that. Some of the questions that I have would concern the gas line, as this committee has obviously become kind of the point for the gas line construction and formulation of where we go from here. Obviously, the memorandum of understanding is fairly critical to the next step of that. And if you could give us just a quick overview as to what the progress has been to this point over the last couple of weeks and where we might be sitting with that.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you, I will leave that to Commissioner Condon, who's actually doing the negotiations.
Thank you. Very good, then.
I would say something like the gas line, though, that it is important that has sometimes been missed. I think now a couple things have developed in the last several weeks. One, of course, is the South Central market, which really has not played. But it's interesting in talking to industry. I mean, we are looking at a potential certainly decline and need for additional gas in South Central Alaska, which not only would go necessarily to the utilities, but also might even go into expansion of the LNG plant and the urea plant on the Kenai Peninsula. So that's a role that I think people haven't really looked much to the gas. And the other thing that people forget, as we look at it, that when you get closer to the Brooks Range up north, there are some real opportunities for gas plays. And so having the gas line may make some of those, open some of those lands up to more aggressive oil and gas leasing.
Very good. Getting back to Representative Hogan's question on the lease sale 85 and the stakeholders group, how are we progressing with the stakeholders group, and what do you see their contribution to lease sale 85 as being?
Gene Burden who we hired as a consultant, as a facilitator to oversee this process, has been here. He's been in Anchorage. He's been on the Kenai meeting with people. We have a sort of a draft of a strategy that I think Gene will finalize in the next several days and make public that that will involve stakeholder meetings that right now we're tentatively scheduling to take place on, I think, the 24th, 25th, and 26th of this month in Kenai, Homer, and Anchor Point. And what Gene has identified about, I think, 7 or 8 key issues that sort of come up over and over again. We will have the stakeholders sort of addressing those issues. We will give the public an opportunity to express their concerns. We will give industry an opportunity to sort of show how they deal with some of these issues. Out of it, I hope to get a couple things. One, I think we will get some changes in our mitigation measures that will strengthen what we are doing, and I think that will be helpful. I also hope we get some recommendations on how to improve the process so that we don't come to the end as we did this time with quite the commotion that we got. So I hope to get both of those things.
Would you see any advantage to any representation from the legislature concerning these stakeholder meetings?
We are going to invite each of the legislators from that area to come. We are looking at a relatively small stakeholder group and probably just one stakeholder group to do the whole lease sale. If the legislature were particularly interested in designating someone, I think the governor would certainly look at that. We haven't, given the fact that you're in session and it's going to require at least 3 days down there and probably several other days, we didn't think that was maybe the best idea to invite someone, but we would be open to such a suggestion.
Okay. I have one other question that would be concerning the cook inlet gas. You touched on it just briefly with the possibility of a spur line coming down to help supply the industry that's now there, which would be Unocal, Phillips, etc. In the Cook Inlet Basin, is there, and forgive me because I probably have heard this before but have forgotten it, is there a domestic use priority with the natural gas in the Cook Inlet Basin?
I don't know the legal answer to that. Certainly for the 12.5% we own, I think if there were a domestic shortage, we would look at using that domestically. But otherwise, I don't know. I would be surprised if there was a domestic priority.
Okay. And then one other question on the gas line, and that would be the Van Mures report. Do we have a sense as to when that will be out, when it will be finalized to present it?
I think I'll delegate that to my friend Commissioner Condon also.
And then one question that I would have, and that would be concerning the national estuary program that is kind of beginning to formulate for Cook Inlet. And I don't really expect an answer today, but if you would keep kind of that flag in your mind, and when you hear about that, if you could consult this committee as far as what the administration might be thinking about, how they might want to join in with that or resist that, however.
Well, it's basically a designation we would have to request. Right now, the discussions are primarily around Kachemak Bay. They're not for all of Cook Inlet. And I would be pleased as we progress to keep the committee informed.
Well, thank you very much. Are there additional questions of Mr. Scheiber? Representative Kemplin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Shively, as our oil and gas industry expands, are you aware of any concerns by the people who are the major players in the industry regarding the availability of sufficiently trained workers to meet the demands of Alaska Hire?
I think there's, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kemplin. I think the industry is concerned that there may not be enough qualified Alaskans, which is why we have a working group put together with the industry, both the major producers themselves and some of the major contractors to the industry, to talk about what those future needs might be and sort of coordinate our training programs that we run in the state with other training programs that might be run by the industry themselves, by unions, by Native organizations. Clearly, particularly if we are to try to bring into that industry people, for instance, off the welfare rolls, now that you know we've had welfare reform, more people from rural Alaska, where we have a large potential workforce, we're going to need to do some training. There's no question about that.
As a follow-up, this working group that you mentioned, will they be presenting the results of their effort in a written format, or are they going to be holding public hearings, or is that just an internal process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kemplin, I don't know if there'll be a written report. Commissioner Cashin basically is the team leader for that for the administration, and Mike Andrews, who's with the Human Resources Investment Council, is the other key person, and you might want to chat with one or both of them about how they're proceeding with that.
Thank you very much.
Further questions?
Chair, on that point, please, Representative Logan. In the discussions I've had with industry, I think there's an anticipated shortage in 98. This year is going to be rather slow in the oil patch, but as North Star and Alpine come online, there's an anticipated shortage. So that's some good news for the Alaskan workers out there, I think. And I think in great part, I'll wave the legislature's flag a little bit on, you know, certainly had a hand in part of that with some of the policies as well as the administration working together on getting some of these projects going.
Thank you. Further questions of Commissioner Shively? I want to thank you very much for coming in, and anything we can do, please call on us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wilson Condon. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, I wasn't exactly sure what the committee would find most helpful in terms of information about where we are today with the gas project. One of the things that you mentioned when we spoke was an interest in market information, and consequently, I've organize my presentation around some thoughts about the market. If you start off thinking about the size of the Alaska project, the number that folks throw out is that they foresee an Alaska project, if it's built, as delivering, when it's operating at full capacity, 14 to 15 million metric tons of LNG per year to the Asian markets. And what does that 14 to 15 million metric tons mean in terms of the volume of energy that represents and the Asian market as it exists today? The Asian market has developed over almost 30 years. The first deliveries of LNG to the Far East took place in 1969 from Alaska. And the first project that was completed for marketing LNG in the Far East, specifically in Japan, was the Kenai LNG project, which for its first 20 years delivered about a million metric tons a year. And as a consequence of the project having a couple of new ships, it now delivers about 1.25 million metric tons of LNG a year, about 1/15th the size of, or 14th the size of what the North Slope project would be if it were constructed, and that's equivalent to about 30,000 barrels of oil a day, the Cook Inlet project. And the North Slope project, if constructed, would be equivalent to about 350,000 barrels a day, or about a quarter of the size of the current energy throughput of the Trans-Alaska oil line. And in terms of thinking about what the Asian market looks like today, it's a market that's grown to about 55 million metric tons a year today. And that is equivalent to just about the throughput of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline in terms of energy. If you think about placing the Alaska gas in the Asian market, the market in Japan today is around 45 to 50 million metric tons per year. So we're talking about an Alaska project that's about one-third the size of the entire Japan market today. And if you look at what's happening in South Korea, in 1997 will probably import about 10 million metric tons of LNG, which is two-thirds the size of the Alaska project that we're talking about. And then when you think about Taiwan as a market, today it's importing about 3 million metric tons. So it is about one-fifth the size in terms of its market of the amount of LNG that we hope will go through the Trans-Alaska gas line if it's constructed. So if you think about those numbers, you immediately can appreciate that figuring out a way to match this project to the needs of the Asian market is going to take some very clever and creative marketing by those who are marketing their gas there. Today there are 8 projects that are delivering gas to the Asian market. We've got the Alaska Cook Inlet project, which was the first one. You've got a project in Brunei, a couple of projects in Indonesia, 2 projects in Malaysia, 1 in Abu Dhabi, 1 in Australia, and 1 in Qatar, which just began delivering its product to the Asian market. And then there are 3 projects which are quite likely to be built that probably sit in front of Alaska in the queue of projects that might deliver LNG to the Asian markets. The Ras Laffan project, a second project in Qatar, is actually under construction. There is a project which has been signed up and which is likely to commence construction soon in Oman. And it's highly likely that the expansion of the Australian project on the Northwest Shelf will take place. And then there are a whole series of new projects that are on the drawing board, which are fighting for a place in the Asian market. And Alaska is among those. And those projects include the recently announced Canadian Pac Rim project, the 2 projects that folks talk about from time to time with respect to the Sakhalin Island in Russia, the 2 projects in Indonesia, one at Natuna and one at Irian Jaya, a project in Papua New Guinea, a project in Yemen, and from time to time people talk about a project in Vietnam, but there really have not been sufficient reserves discovered there to support a project. And so the Alaska project really is fighting for a place in the market among the list of the projects that I just mentioned. In terms of how one puts one of these projects together, it obviously, we know it requires a huge investment at our end. There'll be additional facilities required in the field, a pipeline, a liquefaction plant, and a fleet of ships. In addition, there's going to be the requirement for a huge infrastructure investment in the destination markets. The LNG business requires unloading terminals. It requires storage facilities, requires regasification facilities. If it's going to be used for power, generation. It requires the construction of suitable kinds of power plants. If it's going to be used for home heating, in many cases it requires the construction of a trunk line distribution system, as well as local distribution systems for the gas. And when you're talking about Korea, you're looking at a decision that the Korean government made to establish a nationwide gas grid to deliver gas, and then the construction of many local distribution systems for delivery of the gas. Looking at the major customers, Japan was the first and is now by far the largest of the Asian customers. In Japan, the vast majority of the LNG that is marketed there is used by electric companies to generate power. About three-quarters, in excess of three-quarters of the LNG in Japan is used for electrical generation. There is some used by local utilities. Japan doesn't have a national grid system. It does, however, have utility distribution systems which are hooked up to several of the LNG terminals that have been constructed in Japan. In Korea, the structure is somewhat different. Today, there's one entity that is responsible for all importation of LNG into Korea, and that's Korea Gas. It is a largely government-owned corporation. It has taken upon itself the responsibility of building this nationwide gas distribution system, and the use pattern in Korea is different than in Japan. In Korea today, the use is about 50% for home heating and home use and 50% for electrical generation. Because of the wide variation in seasonal temperatures in Korea, this means that there's a much higher use of gas in the winter season there than there is in the summer season, and that creates an additional set of logistical problems because of the swing in use. People that are at the production end obviously want to have a smooth flow of product to the market. At the consumption end, of course, there's not a smooth use, and this is going to require the Koreans to build a large infrastructure of storage tanks to be able to accommodate the pattern of use that they have. In Korea, the national electric company, which has a monopoly on electric generation in Korea, Korea Electric Power, it will be able to import its own gas in a couple of years, and so at that point the monopoly of Korea Gas will be diluted some. There is the possibility as we move into the next century that in Korea we'll see the development of what are called independent power producing companies, companies that go into the generation business and then just sell their power to the national power grid. And those companies, if they go into, and there are several Korean companies such as Hyundai who are interested in going into that business, and if they do, they are potential customers for LNG as well. And finally, talking about the market in Taiwan, you have the again an exclusive importer today in Chinese Petroleum Corporation. They have the single terminal and distribute the LNG. It's used by the power company of Taiwan, and again, the power company of Taiwan is hopeful that at some point they will enjoy what they see as the good fortune of the Korea Electric Power, and that is to be able to import it LNG directly themselves. And again, in Taiwan, the development of independent power producing companies is something which a lot of people believe will happen. As you think about the Asian market beyond that, and I won't say much about that, but lots of people in thinking about the kind of economic growth that we've seen in Korea and are seeing today in Thailand, in Vietnam, in the Philippines, and in the People's Republic of China, that the energy need is going to be very large, and that LNG is one energy source that matches a lot of potential needs in Asia. And many believe that we'll see this independent power producing company that I mentioned with respect to Korea and Taiwan develop in China as well. When you look at the people who are in the business that you have to deal with in marketing LNG, you of course have in Japan the electric utility companies. Tokyo Electric Power is the largest utility in the world, I believe. Tokyo Gas and a number of other power companies in Japan and a number of other local gas distribution companies. And then you have the very important role that's played by the Japanese trading companies such as Mitsubishi, Mitsui, Marubeni, Nisho Iwai, Sumitomo. All of those companies that I just mentioned participate in some way in a piece of the LNG project. Mitsubishi, Mitsui, and Marubeni have been investors in many of the, in several of the eight projects that I mentioned. Sort of the last point that I would make about the generally talking about the market is that as people talk about fitting Alaska Gas into the marketplace, they often point to the history of the last 28 years over which LNG deliveries have taken place in Asia and point to the trend line and then talk about where the trend line is going to go in the future. But if you think about how this business is put together, it really is not a trend line business. It is a business where people make individual investment decisions at both ends. It's critical that they be made or you can't finance the project. And so what's really, as go to would-be Asian customers and convince them that they ought to use Alaska Gas and make the investment that's required at their end of the the LNG chain. At the same time, companies in Alaska are investing in a pipeline and a liquefaction plant and so on. And so the point I want to make is you really shouldn't just think about it as a line with a slope that's going up, but it's obviously a line that goes up like that as people make investments and decide to use LNG, and while it's certainly takes would take creative marketing, there isn't any reason why you couldn't see either very small jumps or very big jumps if you're clever enough at putting together a deal that matches investment decisions and needs at both at the market end and at the production end. Thinking about just to mention the governor's trip to Asia, which you asked some questions about, while we were in Japan, we met with representatives of the trading companies. We met with representatives of interested government agencies. And we met with the people who were actually in the business of using it for energy, the utility companies. In terms of the representatives of the state itself, we had what I would call official meetings with the trading companies and with government agencies, but we did not have official meetings with the customers. Representatives of the producers who were along did, however, meet with many of the utility company customers, and I think one of the major accomplishments of the trip was this was the first time that the three major North Slope producers went to the market together to solicit interest in the Alaska North Slope gas project. They had all been to the market before, either in pairs or singly, but this was the first time they'd gone as a threesome to solicit interest in the Alaska project. The state did host what it billed as an energy seminar in Tokyo in conjunction with the governor's trip. There were representatives at the seminar from the trading companies, from the utilities, from government agencies. LNG was one of several Alaskan energy products that was talked about at the seminar, the export of coal, and the coal resource in Alaska was discussed, and the export of Alaskan oil was also discussed. Now, Japan has not been yet a major customer of Alaska oil exported following the lifting of the export ban, but Korea and Taiwan have. In Korea, we met on an official basis with several of the government interested government agencies, with Korea Gas and with Korea Electric. And we had an energy seminar there as well, covering all of the same topics. And again, representatives of a wide spectrum of Korean interests were there, government, the representatives of the of Korea Gas and Korea Electric, and then companies that are interested in the business one way or another, as contractors, as would be independent power producers, and so on. As I mentioned, Korea has been become a major customer of Alaska North Slope crude oil, and when you look at the combination of the spot sales to Japan, the long-term sales that have been negotiated for delivery to Korea and Taiwan, today there's over 100,000 barrels a day of ANS crude oil being exported to the Far East, and that has turned out to be a very fortunate turn of events for Alaska, as some of the academic types who looked at the lifting of the export ban shortly before it occurred forecast that no Alaskan oil would be exported once the export ban was lifted. And I'm happy to say that their analysis turned out to be incorrect. I think I've probably gone on long enough about both the gas line and what we learned in Asia, and I'd be happy to answer questions that I can answer, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for that fine overview. Do we have questions of the committee? Representative Bundy.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, currently, apparently, it's a focus on Korea and Japan, and both for our oil and gas. And I'm just wondering, do you anticipate increased government-to-government contact with China, or what's happening in the arena of the China game?
With respect to the People's Republic of China, it's, I think, premature in the gas area. We really need to see how the business develops there, at least as far as the government is concerned. And we'll have to wait and see what the gas owners and marketers want to do. I didn't mention it, but it is the case that Anis crude oil has been successfully marketed to the People's Republic of China. They're one of BP's customers in Asia.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just a follow-up, and I guess I was using China more generically and thinking it was Hong Kong as well as the People's Republic, and again, has Alaska had official dialogue with Hong Kong and its role now as it changes as perhaps the commercial door to the People's Republic?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, we have not at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bundy. Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, Will. Good to see you again. Commissioner, one of your comments, you said we needed clear and creative marketing for our natural gas, and I think we all know in this room, or most of us do at least, and I hope those that are listening in the television audience know that we've made like significant progress in the last year with this issue, and I kind of characterize it as the state is kind of the choir director, and we have maybe four different choirs right now, three of them producers, one of them an outfit that wants to build a pipeline, and we're all singing the same song now, which is very encouraging. However, I think we still have several different choirs, and maybe we're not all singing in the same key. So I guess what I'm leading up to is, do you think the perception of the market is that we are making improvements in what I believe we were perceived as dysfunctional before, because there has never been the producers as a whole going to the market and discussing. I think that's a major improvement. Do you think the market views this as a viable option at this point? And if not, is the memorandum of understanding going to further enhance our perception, or if what needs to happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ogun, for the most part, in terms of talking about the market, I would be speculating to talk about what is in the minds of would-be purchasers. While we were on our trip to Asia, the people in both responsible people in commercial firms in both Japan and Korea expressed great interest in the Alaska project. To them, of course, they're some key principles. They are nervous about government involvement. By government involvement, I mean a situation where they see the United States of America trying to dictate that they buy a certain amount of gas from the United States under certain terms. And that comes about as a consequence of their perception of government statements that were made in the 1980s. Nevertheless, they welcome what they would characterize as the right kind of government support, which means no dictation, and they're very anxious that any project. Well, they're simply not going to participate in a project that's not commercially viable. But as they look at Alaska and think about their current dependence on Southeast Asia and a growing dependence on LNG from the Middle East, they see Alaska as, if it can be done economically, a fantastic addition to their energy portfolio in terms of diversifying it. The very same way investors think about diversifying their investment portfolio, it's important for an economy like each of these Asian countries to diversify their energy portfolio. In terms of what people actually said about getting our act together and singing on the same sheet of music, the only entity that really talked to us about that was Korea Gas, and they made the statement that we still, they, from their perspective, we still had some homework to do.
Yeah, you spoke briefly, thank you, Mr. Chairman, about the export ban. Could you maybe explain to those that might not understand that, and see if I'm correct in my analogy here, and I'll go out on a limb here to prove whether or not I'm ignorant, but we actually increase the revenues to the state on oil that we export to Pacific Rim because there's lower transportation costs. Is that a fair analysis?
Representative Ogun, yes. There are really two effects that take place. From the early days of North Slope oil production, there was more oil in the West Coast area of the United States with the addition of the Alaska oil than people driving cars and running power plants and so on were using. And so there was there wasn't enough room in the West Coast market to fit all of the ANS into. And as a consequence of that, and as a consequence of the export ban, that oil went elsewhere in the United States or in United States possessions. Most that had to move on went down to Central America and either through the Panama Canal or across Panama on a pipeline and then was marketed in the Gulf Coast area. But a not insignificant volume went around the end of South America and to the Amerada Hess refineries in the U.S. Virgin Islands. As a consequence of that, while the price on the West Coast was somewhat depressed from what it would have been had the marketplace been such that it was Alaska oil competing against Saudi oil or Indonesian oil for a place in the Puget Sound or San Francisco or Los Angeles. And of course, once Alaska oil got to the Gulf Coast, it was competing in the world marketplace, but it picked up the transportation charge that it cost to get it there. So there really were two effects. One was the depression in West Coast market values as a consequence of an oversupply, and two was the added transportation cost for that oil that was being bought and sold at world market prices, but at a further distance away. Once the export ban was lifted, the transportation cost of moving oil all the way to the Gulf Coast was reduced considerably. It does cost a little more to take U.S. oil or to take Alaskan oil to the Orient than it does to California, but it costs less to go to the Orient than it does to Houston. And then we see the simultaneous increase in values of oil on the West Coast. Once the export ban is removed, we see West Coast oil moving at world market values most of the time. So those two effects.
Very articulate answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bundy, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Commissioner, when you... in response to a previous question from Representative Ogun, talked about Korea and getting our act together, triggered a question for me. For some years, certainly in the time I've been here, we've heard very consistently from producers in Alaska, private corporations, articulating a need for a stable fiscal climate, a stable taxing policy in the state of Alaska to encourage business. I'm just wondering whether in your trip to the Orient, whether there was any concern generated of whether we are continuing to have a stable fiscal policy in Alaska, whether we're politically stable. Are these concerns that have arisen?
Uh, Mr. Chair, Representative Bundy, the answer to that question is yes. Everyone who is in this business is anxious to or is thinking about what kind of fiscal stability they will have if they make the kind of investment that's required for a project like this. And it is the case that a gas project from Alaska, if it's economic, will be economic under terms where it requires that the investors get the money they expect over a much longer period of time than would be the case for a typical oil investment. The economics for an investment like this are simply a lot thinner. And the deals that you have to put together to make one of these projects economic require long-term, very long-term contractual commitments. And so there is a concern that investors believe, as they look at Alaska, that they won't finally get to the point where they start to get their money back and then not be able to get it because of a major change in state fiscal policy. Whether you talk to the customers like Tokyo Gas and Tokyo Electric, or the trading companies who put their own money into these deals around the world, or our own producing companies, they all make the same point, and I believe that it is one which is, in fact, heartfelt. There are things which bear on this as people look at Alaska. It's not just what the taxes look like and so on, but it's certainly the case that investors feel more comfortable, would feel more comfortable if there were a long-term a consensus on how government was going to be financed in the longer term. And they look at things like the Budget Reserve Fund and make the judgment that, well, if that is still there, you know, if that fund sticks around and it truly is a budget reserve fund, then investors are not going to be fearful that if they invest a lot of money here, all of a sudden they'll be hit with an emergency tax of some kind if the energy prices decline precipitously. And so as investors from around the world look at Alaska and think about this project, one of the things we do have to sell is the fact that we have this budget reserve, which protects investors against a sudden tax if there is a sudden need. And, of course, as they watch, they certainly will watch to see whether we try to preserve some of it or whether we spend it all before we put together a long-term financing plan.
Any follow-up?
I'm asking for a lot of speculation here. I probably from what you had to say, then I would interpret it as that any attempt to capitalize the budget reserve fund and make it another permanent fund may not increase their comfort level. And certainly the spending of the entire fund would decrease their comfort level. And are you saying that continuing in its present fashion, the CBR is perhaps something that will enhance the comfort level as investors look at the project?
I don't think investors, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, I don't think investors are looking at it that closely. If the entire fund was capitalized and there was no reserve at all that was available, they would probably think about it differently than if there was some obvious reserve available. I don't think as we think about our own budget and where we are, does the available reserve that we have to be able to get by at an unexpected period of low energy prices, we certainly don't need a reserve that's as large as the current budget reserve fund.
Thank you. And just one
please
follow up on a back to the People's Republic. I would just encourage you to take, I guess, a broader view, and rather than waiting for them to ask us, if you would keep it in the back of your mind that perhaps we ought to be encouraging them to think of Alaska, and instead of if we build it, they will come, maybe perhaps we could invite them before we build it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Ryan. Yeah.
Commissioner Condon, the Japanese have, for the last 30 or so years, dealt with a lot of people internationally, and a lot of people have come back without their shirt. These people are very good at what they do. And some of the things you tell me about the large trading companies wanting to put up the money for the basic infrastructure, and then a Japanese energy company wanting to buy it, the product, that I know they're going to ask for certain concessions for providing the funds and so forth. Are you comfortable with your folks that are going to do negotiation, having had the experience of dealing with these people, so that they are familiar with the nuances and so forth? There's quite a long involved process in negotiating with Japanese. Having lived there for some years, I have some arcane knowledge of how they go about doing things.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, at this time, I'm not certain what, if any, kind of contractual arrangements we would have or we would be negotiating ourselves with the Japanese. It's a little early to tell how that might unfold, but I would say a couple of things about how the Japanese have dealt with these kinds of projects. Clearly, Japan does business as Japan Inc. And if they participate in one of these projects as a customer or as an investor, they try to make sure that there's Japanese participation in terms of supplying components and so on. They take care of a wide spectrum of interests whenever they participate. But the importation of LNG has been very, very important to them, and they negotiate fiercely in terms of coming up with a particular price at a particular time, they are also they've also proven themselves very willing to change the deal in a fair way when economic conditions change. And that was the case with the Phillips Marathon arrangements in the Cook Inlet. They had a long-term fixed-price contract of 52 cents a million BTUs and a delivery, if there was above a threshold delivery, another nickel for 57 cents. And when energy prices went through the ceiling in the 1973-74 time period, even though they had a contract that says 52 cents, but if times change, we'll get together and talk about it, they got together and talked about it and substantially changed the pricing terms in that contract to recognize the changes in energy prices. So it is, while they certainly have covered a lot of bases in terms of making sure that they got as many ships into the trade as possible and as much steel into the pipe as possible and so on, they've been very fair in adjusting prices to make sure that they have a relationship with their suppliers that make their suppliers feel reasonably good.
Follow-up question? Go ahead.
Yeah, one other question. You mentioned the Alaska North Slope crude being sold in the Far East. Is that being sold in the swap market or by contract?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, almost all of it is being sold on term contracts. There have been some spot sales, and I have not looked carefully since mid-December. Up to that point, there had been no term sales in Japan, and I don't know whether there have been any since.
Well, one other thing, if I may follow up, I follow Southeast Asia as a hobby, and I know there is a large demand for coal for industrial manufacture and large cement drying plants as an energy source. Do you think it could be supplanted with natural gas? Are we competitive with coal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, I don't believe that for that kind of use, natural gas, at least natural gas from this part of the world, would be competitive with coal. Coal sells on a per BTU basis for something like 50% of what LNG sells for in the Far East, liquefied natural gas gets the premium price that it gets, at least in the power generation area, because of the tremendous efficiency that you get out of a combined cycle turbine compared to a coal-fired power plant. But where you're just looking at heat, and not trying to convert heat to electrical energy, I think it would be very hard for LNG to win the day. LNG has won the day in Korea for environmental reasons. They had the home heating was done there by locally mined anthracite coal, a tremendous pollution problem and a national government decision to stop using coal. And since they made that decision in the mid-80s, coal use in Korea for home heating has dropped dramatically. It continues to be widely used in power plants where you can use the kind of technology that eliminates the pollution problem.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Just a second. Let me ask two questions here first. Could you give us the status of the MOUs at this point, and then also the status of the vendors report?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. The MOUs are not yet finally negotiated. The three points were still remained on the table when we appeared before Representative Barnes' committee. Two of those have been resolved, and we're still working on the third. Dr. Van Muir's report should be here in final on or about Valentine's Day.
And then will Dr. Van Muir's be available for?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Van Muir's plans to come up here during the week of March 10th, and he'll be in the state for 4 days that week, and then if there are reasons, and my guess is there will be reasons for him to come back again, there'll be some time later, but we're not sure right now when that will be.
I will try to facilitate a joint meeting between oil and gas and world trade, if that can be done, to visit with Dr. Van Muir's. Representative Kemplin, you had a...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Condon, you mentioned about the investors' concerns for some sort of fiscal certainty. Over the past six months to a year, there's been a lot of discussion about the fiscal gap and a number of different alternatives proposed to address the fiscal situation of the state. Any one or combination or more than one of those alternatives would meet the requirements of these investors for certainty? thereafter?
Representative Kemplin, they're really the concern about, as investors, about two different things. One is what kind of fiscal terms will they be subjected to? What kind of taxes, what kind of royalties will they have to pay with respect to the gas that would be marketed through this project? And then they're concerned as well about the financial stability of the state. And I don't, they may have, if they're doing business in the state or citizens of the state, have their own particular views about what combination of tools the state ought to use to assure itself of a stable long-term financial future. But I think that they wouldn't have a preference as long as they weren't the ones who had to pay the bill.
Okay. Another, please. Another question that you had, another point you brought up, I think regarding Korea, and you made a comment that they felt that Alaska still had some homework to do. What's your estimate of when that homework will be done?
My estimate of when that homework will be done is when we finally have a set of contracts in place and commitments to go build this project. Mm-hmm. And that might be 2.5 years from now, and it might be a decade from now, and we're obviously going to do our best to make it sooner rather than later.
Thanks.
Does that complete your questions?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions, Commissioner? I want to thank you very much for your overview, and as I offered to Commissioner Shively, if there's any way that this committee can help you and your department in going forward and creating Alaskan jobs and wise use of our resources, we're at your disposal. And I thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity for appearing.
Thank you. To the committee members that are here, I did get a report from, and this is just for your information, on a new technology and a gas line. And I will have a representative from I don't have the name of the outfit here, that will be in my office at 1 o'clock on Monday. And if any of the committee members would like to attend the briefing on this composite reinforced line, I would certainly accommodate you. As far as the this committee, we are going to be the main point on the TAGS hearings. It will be this committee's responsibility to carry forward what needs to be done to see the Trans-Alaska Gas Line built and to facilitate it in a reasonable time. I have a fairly aggressive schedule that I will get to committee members as far as what I perceive we need to do, and I would certainly welcome input from members to facilitate our goals. I will ask that we have some of the Cook Inlet folks in next week, and we'll talk about the gas shortages that they perceive in the Cook Inlet area in the next few years, and start a basis as to how we can get a spur line from the Trans-Alaska Gas Line into South Central Alaska. I've also requested several bits of information, and I will make those available to the committee members based on field development plans for North Slope, management of Prudhoe Bay, and what series of agreements and amendments have come forward that might affect the sale of gas. We'll be looking at the Prudhoe Bay unit gas handling agreements, the issues resolution agreements and the settlement of waste claims that have just occurred. And it's my intentions to give us the best overview that we possibly can to go forward to help kick this very critical project into reality. And with that, if we have any committee comments at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say I applaud your efforts in this area and look forward to working with you on this project and any support that the Resource Committee can be as well.
Well, thank you. And I do appreciate the field of expertise that we have on this committee, being that we have many members that have sat on this committee in past years. Any further comments before I adjourn the meeting?
Well, just, Mr. Chairman, there are far worse things to kick than reality.
Yes, yes, I believe so. With that, I would adjourn this meeting, and thank you.